Welcome to Historically Thinking, a program devoted to all kinds of historical knowledge and to the ways that we achieve it. I'm your host, Al Zambone, of the Department of History at Augustana College. Our website is historicallythinking.org, where you can subscribe, find more information about our guests, links, and related readings. Our email address is mail@historicallythinking.org. We'd love to hear from you. Hello. Often historians and teachers in general speak about coverage and covering and use the verb to cover in ways that perhaps few outside academia actually do. We worry at the end of a semester, right around this time of the year, that we haven't covered all the right things. People teaching the first part of an American history survey will worry if they've covered Reconstruction in sufficient depth. People teaching the second part of the history survey will complain and feel very self-conscious they didn't get beyond 1968, and therefore they haven't covered the 1970s or the 1980s. Covering, coverage. We cover things when we go over them. We also cover things when we try to conceal them. What's the connection? And what does Lendell Calder, my colleague in the Department of History, mean by the word uncoverage? He's here to discuss his thought on uncoverage, the things that he's been working on for the last decade or so, and the pedagogy of history, and help me discover how I can kick my coverage habit. So why do we try to cover things, Lendell?
I think we try to cover things because the standard for what it means to be a good teacher is that you start at point A and you talk about points B, C, D, E, and F on the way to Z, which was last year. And yeah. If you're a good teacher, you talk about all of those things.
And is that sort of then how we measure our success as well?
Exactly. By how much ground you traversed in the course of a semester.
So what's wrong with that?
Well, what does it mean to be good at history? That's the question that we need to be thinking about. And the classic understanding of that, being good at history means remembering who Columbus was, remembering the great canon of actors in American history and what they did and why they did it. Being good at history means remembering what a teacher told you. Being good at history means remembering what you read in a textbook.
So good historians have good memories.
That's what a student walks away thinking it means when a teacher tries to base a course around the coverage model. They unwittingly teach that being good at history is about remembering.
So I don't forget what year this was, but in the Journal of American History, I believe, you had a very influential article that I know you still receive emails about. Called uncoverage. What were you challenging about the coverage model? What were you proposing instead?
What I proposed was that we reconsider what it means to be good at history, especially for beginning students. Instead of asking them to remember things, either discrete facts that they can remember on a test or arguments that we make in class that they then repeat in a paper that we ask them to write. Instead of remembering what the book said or what the professor said, we do some thinking, each one of us, about what it actually means to be good at history. There's no firm consensus in our profession over what that question means, although I think all of us know it doesn't mean remembering things, even though the way we teach tends to put that across. So, myself, I sat down and I thought, what do I think? What is a beginning student in history, someone taking an introductory history course, what do they need to be good at out in the world after graduation?
So you're saying that oftentimes we're teaching in ways that are very different from the way we actually practice history.
That's exactly right.
And yet somehow we are...
Historians don't go around remembering things.
We're awful at it, actually.
I'm terrible at it. Yeah. Somebody, my interview calls me, wants to know, that's something I've written about. Half the time I can't remember it. I have to look it up myself.
Yeah, let alone dates when things happen. I'm awful at dates.
I'm terrible at dates. Yeah. I can't even remember how old I am.
My students always think I'm joking, and I am. But they always think I'm not telling the truth. When I say, as a historian, I'm very bad at memorizing dates or remembering dates.
Yeah. So for myself, I sat down and thought, what does a kid need to be good at, to be good at history for an introductory course? And I came up with six thinking skills, six cognitive moves that a student thinking about the past needs to do it well. Mm-hmm. And I shifted my attention in my introductory course away from covering tons and tons of material to exercises designed to teach these thinking skills.
What led you? What was then? And this is a leading question because I know the answer. But what was the moment that led you to rethinking what you were doing?
Yeah, I had a moment in my first year of teaching that I now call the day the professor died. And I was teaching a class of 250 students in a large lecture hall, and I was teaching them the way I was taught. I was giving them some really dynamite lectures.
Yeah.
I was staying up all night, every night, my first year of teaching, to write these lectures. They weren't very good, but they were as good as I could make them at the time. And I was working really hard to be a good lecturer. And one day while I was talking about Martin Luther King and the Selma campaign, I actually delivered such a powerful oration that I made myself cry.
You were swayed by your own oratory.
I was.
It was a wonderful moment for any professor.
I don't mean
professor.
To be immodest, but it could have been maybe the finest lecture ever given about Martin Luther King. I don't know, but it made me cry.
But it certainly you were caught up in your own rhetoric, yeah. Which is, you know.
And as I paused in mid-sentence to push a tear away, I became conscious that some kids in the class were laughing. And my first thought was they were just uncomfortable with the professor pausing to shed a tear. But as I became conscious of my surroundings, I realized they weren't even aware of me. They were laughing at something they were looking at. And while I was marching with King at Selma, about half the kids in this room had been passing around pictures from a frat party earlier in the week, and they were laughing at those. Mm. I got angry. I stormed out of the class. I didn't come back. And that day, as I reflected on that incident, I learned something. It would be years before I articulated what I learned the way I do now. But what I learned was that it's not about what a teacher says. It's about what students hear. And most of the time in a coverage-oriented class, students are not hearing what you think they are.
Yeah, and they are. That's a great story because oftentimes a new teacher will say, if they've got an incident like that, is I need to lecture better.
Exactly.
I need to write better lectures. I need to do all
that. That was my first.
That was your first thing. Yeah.
Teaching is hard, and these moments happen, and they hurt when they happen.
Yeah.
So we build defenses and retreat behind them in order to shield our egos. And one of the defenses is I could be a better lecturer, but an even more common defense is it's their fault.
Yeah.
They don't deserve my brilliance.
Yeah.
And I did that for a while, got angry at the students. Right. And another defense is you get angry at the high school history teachers.
Yep.
For not preparing them to receive your brilliance.
Or one department meeting in which I was present, it devolved into a discussion of the anti-intellectualism of American culture.
That's a good defense.
It's a very good
blame
one.
Blame it on the culture.
Because we can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
And so therefore we don't have to change.
Yeah. But the reality is these are, even if some of these defenses have some truth to them.
Sure.
They're defenses and they don't change the facts on the ground in the moment, yeah. Which is, quite a lot of student disinterest in history rests squarely on our shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
As teachers. We're not engaging them in a way that they could be engaged. And Uncoverage developed out of a desire to reach a kind of student who's not particularly interested in history, but is open-minded about it and willing with a different approach to give it a shot. Right now... And this goes back to defenses. Right now, when an incident like mine happens, a teacher can console herself saying, well, you know, the best students, they get me.
Yeah.
I've got two or three great students, and you pour your energy into them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, with UnCoverage, what I wanted to do was get beyond the two or three great students who are going to learn no matter what, and try to get that half of the room that isn't learning but could be learning if they were taught better. I have no illusions that UnCoverage reaches every student. I'm sure it doesn't. But I'm reaching more students now and teaching them to be pretty good historical thinkers than I ever was back in the day when I was covering material.
I want to get to the mechanics of what one of your classes looks like in a couple minutes. But first, what about the resistance to these ideas? It always fascinates me. And now I've encountered it amongst my peers, or first-year teachers, who are, and you've encountered it in many, many, many places. Could you describe some of the reactions of the sort of the pushback that you've received? There's some good responses. There's some amusing ones, at least.
I don't want to overemphasize resistance because I've been pleased by just how
we can get to that later.
Eager people have been to come off the stage, so to speak.
But I think the resistance gets to some of the defenses as well that we have against it.
Yeah. People put a lot of work into lectures, and the lectures are good lectures in many cases. It's often true, too, that we learned very well from listening to lectures.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to put yourself in the shoes of someone who's different from you, who just doesn't learn that way.
Mm-hmm.
I think for some people, the biggest hurdle to get over here is they perceive that switching from coverage to other approaches is a challenge to their authority. When you're the lecturer, you know, you command an audience. You're in control.
Yeah.
And all of the knowledge that you accumulated over the years is laid out in a pleasing way for students to master. When you step away from that, it can feel like a squandering of what you've worked so hard to accomplish. It felt like that to me the first couple of years I was experimenting with new approaches. I put a lot of effort in graduate school and in my historical studies since to know some things. It can feel strange to be the leader of a class where the students do more talking than you do.
Mm-hmm. What was the fellow who said that at least I'm doing things, I might be doing things wrong?
Yeah, after giving a talk to some professors, a fellow approached me and he raised his hand, and in the question and answer, in a half-joking way, he said, I may be doing it all wrong, but I'm doing it in the traditional way.
Yeah.
Professors are very busy.
Yeah.
And especially at research universities, we're quite busy with our scholarship. And that doesn't leave a lot of room for thinking about teaching. And to reconfigure how you teach requires just as much intellectual energy as any scholarly project that you work on. And a lot of people aren't going to want
to
do that.
It was always explained to me that the first 2 years would be very busy because then you write all the lectures, but then you just update them for the rest of your career.
We've all had professors like that who pulled out their yellowed notes and just had made additions in the margin.
Yeah.
I mean, good lecturers aren't like that. They continually rewrite lectures.
Well, some of those guys who had the yellow notes actually were pretty good. I mean, I had a professor who at the time I thought was fantastic. He had memorized everything. He could just go on this. It looked like a magical monologue where he was speaking about all the German history and political thought without referring to anything.
He was. I think of myself as being someone who can learn pretty well from listening to lectures, but You don't. I didn't learn as much as I thought. I have all my undergraduate papers.
Yeah.
And I was a good student. I was an A student. But when I compare my undergraduate history essays to what my students now are writing, I had higher scores on tests than they do probably.
Mm-hmm.
I was an A student. I bet I would say my B students now are writing better history essays than I wrote as an undergraduate. Because mine were just cut and paste jobs.
Yeah.
Nobody was teaching me the moves of historical thinking, so I didn't know how to do them. I was a good writer, had good prose style, and that got me A's. But there's not a whole lot of thinking going on in my undergraduate essays. My students now probably aren't as good prose stylists as I was at their age, but they're actually thinking in these essays.
Mm-hmm. But before we get to the mechanics that you just touched on again, it's interesting to me, we're all heroes of our own story. And what always strikes me, I'm talking with women, this doesn't happen just for teachers, but we do tend to think that if it worked for us,
yeah, it
must work for others. And we teachers are always looking, I think one of the great weaknesses of teachers, of good teachers even, is looking for themselves and their students and then nurturing those students who most resemble themselves.
Yeah.
And then letting them to rise up, as it were.
Well, this is why we want to think about teaching reform at the level of a department, not at the level of individual instructors, because no instructor can be all things to all people. And to get a good history, to get good at historical thinking, you need to be taught by three or four professors, each with their particular gifts.
So talk about the mechanics of UnCoverage in the classroom. How do you start out teaching the, say, American survey?
Well, first of all, I literally throw the textbook out. I don't use a textbook, and I make no effort to cover all important periods or events.
What's wrong with textbooks? There are so many of them. They must be good.
The problem with the textbook, and I believe this, I mean, I keep up with textbooks. Every time a new one comes out, I take a look. The problem with textbooks is they don't have an argument like real history does. And they don't really have a story, although some of them make an attempt to have a narrative style. There's no big story in a textbook. There used to be back in, right after World War II, mm-hmm. Morrison's textbook mm-hmm. had a big story, I think.
Yeah, Morrison's textbook doesn't look like a textbook now. I mean,
No. Real history has an argument to make, and the argument's usually made in the form of some kind of great story or meta-narrative. So I'm a big believer that we need to return to the teaching of big stories in our history courses, because it's from these big stories that meaning emerges. And without it, I'm finding students believe history's just one thing after another, one fact, one episode, one event, one cause after another, and it doesn't add up to anything. So they tune out.
Yeah, we never had the discussion, and probably we should on another program, about whether the suspicion of the meta-narrative led to the triumph of the textbook, which is sort of based on USA Today, the theme, the sidebar, all the rest of that stuff.
Yeah, another topic.
Yeah, it's another topic. But so you get rid of the textbook.
Instead of a textbook, I think it works best to have students read two books, at least two books,
yeah,
on whatever your topic is, that approach it with a different point of view.
So what are the ones that you use?
For many years now, I've been using Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States and pairing it with Paul Johnson's much more conservative history, A History of the American People.
And that's an interesting choice, because Zinn, of course, is a man of the left and Johnson's a man of the right, but there are more similarities than might first...
This works beautifully for me, because they're both about the same age. They both fought in World War II, but one's an American and one's a Brit. Both started on the left. One converted in midlife, mm-hmm. became a neoconservative. One is a magnificent prose stylist with a tremendous vocabulary, and Howard Zinn writes in also in a beautiful style, but one that's pitched at a very different level.
Very clear and very direct, but without any...
Extremely good storyteller.
Without any ornate flourishes whatsoever. Johnson is much more almost 18th century, certainly 19th mm-hmm. century in his prose style.
So, you know, if history is an argument without end, as we all teach our students it is, they have to see that in the texts that they read. And that's the problem with a textbook.
Yeah.
They don't see that. Now, publishers and authors of textbooks can make an effort to put in sidebars with arguments and stuff. I'm not convinced that's enough to counter the overwhelming impression one gets from reading a textbook that there's one story, the story that the authors are telling, and that constitutes, or that knowing that story constitutes being good at history.
We really ought to get a grant to do this, but my extremely unscientific survey of class after class after class is that even in the most gee whiz sidebar heavy textbook, students only will read the main page if they read anything at all.
That's another problem with textbooks.
Avoid the sidebars.
Students don't read them.
Yeah, that is the problem.
I believe there's some pretty good data out there, much of it not made public because it's sponsored by textbook publishers, that show students don't read them. Even buy them.
That was the opinion of Lendl Calder, not of Augustana College, WAUG, or the producer of this program. Yeah, please go on. So
So I don't have that problem in my course. I know my students are reading what I assign them. For one thing, they have to take a quiz over their reading.
What do you quiz them on?
I just quiz them on one thing. What was the main point of the reading for today? Because this is argument-driven history now. Mm-hmm. There's always a main point, and Mr. Zinn always disagrees with Mr. Johnson, and we talk about that. That's much more closely resembles what history feels like when I'm doing it with you, Al, than in the old days when I was talking to students about what was in a textbook or about what I thought the historical narrative was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because after all, we try to create that argument when we have them read a textbook, but then repeating the exact same set of facts in our own preferred way in a lecture.
I think it is possible to teach students to argue with the textbook. Sam Weinberg's had some great, and his associates at Stanford are having some good success with that model. But that's a high school audience that they're working with. And I think in college, we can ditch the textbook and go to real histories, at least for United States history. It might be harder for other regional histories at the introductory level.
Mm-hmm. So what's the second step that you make? You ditch the textbook?
The key thing you have to do in an uncoverage model after showing them that history is an argument is you've got to get them into primary documents and making sense of them. My class is organized into units. We'll give three class meetings in each unit to a subject like World War II or the Cold War. The first day, I have students watch a film about the subject that reminds them about basic facts about World War II, say. I choose different kinds of films so that we can talk about visual literacy and develop some skills of interpreting moving images. And we use the film to generate questions. That's one of my six thinking skills that I'm teaching students in the introductory course, how to ask good historical questions. If you don't have a good question, if you're not in control of the questions you're asking, I don't think piling up historical knowledge matters very much.
Mm-hmm.
So the film will generate questions we have about World War II, say. And then students go and jump into primary documents to try to look for answers to the question that they're after.
Okay.
And in the early days when I was developing an uncoverage approach, I just threw them in the deep end of the pool and expected them to be able to teach themselves how to swim, and figured out pretty quick that will never happen.
So,
historical thinking is not easy. It has to be taught. So now, week by week, I roll out a new historical thinking skill.
And
we practice it in class on the second day of the unit. We start with asking good historical questions.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know how to do that. They want to ask moral questions, for example,
mm-hmm.
often. It's surprising for for a generation that has grown up in a kind of non-judgmental mode, they are quick to want to judge people of the past.
They really get there fast.
Was it right that Truman dropped the atomic bomb? You know, they want to talk about that. So I have to teach them what a historical question is and why it should have primacy over moral questions that are the most interesting questions we can ask, but have to be put on the shelf for a while so we can investigate the history of these things. Making connections is another skill. They tend to read documents, summarize them, and stop with that. So you have to teach them how to connect documents to other documents. I teach them how to make historical arguments and what the steps in an argument are. Teach them to look from different perspectives. Students who've graduated high school usually know the basics of an argument, but they are quick to latch on to a thesis and then turn that into something black and white and defend it at all costs, rather than to be open to a different point of view that could alter their thesis. So I teach them that move. I teach them how important it is to recognize that every argument has naysayers, people who disagree, and to have a conversation with those naysayers within the context of your paper.
This is where They Say, I Say by Graf and Bergenstein has really changed your approach, right, or added to it?
No, I mean, everybody who's gone through graduate school knows this move.
It's true.
That you, if you're going to write about a historical subject, you've got to enter into conversation with those who've also written about your subject. What Graf and Bergenstein have done really well in their slim little book has given us some wonderful, they've named the concepts.
Yeah.
So they call what I call entertaining a different point of view.
Yeah.
They say you've got to deal with naysayers.
Right. Yeah. Or it's a great little book.
Yeah,
fantastic little book.
And I'm at Augustana. It's our composition textbook, basically.
Yeah. So, ditch the textbook, primary documents, teaching these skills. What else is part of the uncovering?
On the second day of each unit, we're working on these historical thinking skills, and we do that in the form of a conversation where students have read the documents, tried to answer a question they had, and they come to class, and we talk about the questions that are on their minds. And that's a freewheeling day. I'm not in charge of it since I didn't bring the questions. And as the kids talk back and forth about answers to their questions, I occasionally stop the action, like a referee will call time out, and I'll point out something they could do better with this particular thinking.
Give a for instance.
Yesterday in class, we heard from three students, and the fourth student actually pinned what she was saying to direct quotations from a document. Whereas the prior three students had basically were airing their opinions out without any reference to evidence at all. So when this fourth student did that, I called time out and I said, Hillary did something really cool. Does anybody know what it was? And another kid on the other side of the room raised his hand and he said, yeah, she grounded what she was saying in one of the documents. And I said, bingo. And next five comments all grounded what they said in a document. See, that's what that class looks like. I run it on a sports analogy. It's like a soccer game. As the teacher, I will decide what question we're going to talk about. It's one of their questions. I'll pick one out, put it in play, and they start talking. And every once in a while, as a coach, I stop the action to teach them a move or to point out something good they did. Occasionally point out stuff that's not happening. Like if we go more than 5 minutes and nobody has said, what's the evidence for that? I will stop play and say, somebody please ask, what's the evidence for that? And I can imagine someone listening to me saying, that sounds so hokey, almost demeaning to me as a professor to be doing that.
Obviously you disagree.
To me, that feels delightful. It is so fun to be doing this. It's it I think I definitely would be one of those professors who, if I just kept lecturing off of my notes every year, year after year, I would get pretty tired and bored with that and start mailing it in. Mm-hmm. Doing history this way, every course is different. Every class day is a little different. It's similar enough that I'm getting better at it as a teacher, but it's different enough that it's really got my interest and that keeps my energy level high.
And so on the third day of the unit, what do they do?
On the third day of the unit, after they've developed questions from watching a film and jumped into documents to try to answer their questions, on the third day we read the two historians on the same subject. Mm-hmm. And in the historian's books, they're encountering the documents that they read already, which makes them more discerning reader of Zinn and Johnson. Mm-hmm. They encounter arguments that we had already met in a kind of inchoate form on our workshop day. And that it's students are tentative about their ideas, and it means a lot to a student to find, oh my gosh, what I was saying in class is what Zinn is saying here. Mm-hmm. I'm not crazy. Mm-hmm. And on that third day, I have a lot more control on the third day. I'll actually lecture on the third day.
So that's just, you're not against lecturing as a moral failure, right?
Not at all. Yeah. I still lecture, but now the lecture fits into a larger strategy of teaching. Mm-hmm. We compare Zinn and Johnson. Mm-hmm. Our question on this third day is, who's the better historian mm-hmm. on this topic? The ultimate assignment in my course now is students have to write a memo to the National Council on History Education recommending that one or the other of these histories should be given to every adult American citizen mm-hmm. as part of a national book reading club on American history.
So you've got, at Augustana, we have 10-week terms, three of them. So you've got a 10-week term, that means 10 units.
Do an introductory unit that's historiographical in nature. What is history? Mm-hmm. And then nine units.
We have a, at least kind of saying, we have a 1945 to basically present.
For this course that I usually teach.
Yeah, I teach the 1492 to 1865. Mm-hmm. There's a difference in time span. I'll just point that out to the listeners there. What do you cover everything? Do you cover enough level?
Of course not. I leave out so much, even in a 1945 to present.
Where you could
time frame, I leave out so much. For example, we almost never talk about Watergate.
Really?
Never. Just didn't come up. But here's the thing. Both Zinn and Johnson have paragraphs about Watergate, and the mm-hmm. students read those paragraphs. Mm-hmm. So it's not like a student reading the readings couldn't learn about Watergate. It's just, it never comes up in class, because that's not one of the problems I've selected for our units. How is that any different from a lecturer who touches on Watergate over mm-hmm. a 20-minute lecture? You know.
Yeah, and
I bet they might actually even engage more words on Watergate through Zinn and Johnson than a lecturer who talks about Watergate for 20 minutes on a particular lecture.
Yeah.
And never returns to it again. How is that any different?
And even if they are lecturing up for 20 minutes on Watergate, they're going to not speak about something else. Maybe the fall of Saigon, the strategic assault one and two talks, something.
In a way, what I'm doing is flipping the classroom before mm-hmm. anybody was talking about flipping the classroom. My students, our history gets covered for my students in the readings. Mm-hmm. But we're not covering it in class. In class, we're doing exercises designed to teach historical thinking.
We're getting towards the end of the program. You've talked about naysayers, introducing naysayers, understanding naysayers. What's the best naysayer to the uncoverage model? What's the best argument that you against what you've proposed and what you do that you've encountered?
It would go something like this, I think. Al, could you swim to Hawaii?
No, I could not.
No, nobody could. What if I put you on a boat that got you 10 miles off the coast of San Francisco? Could you swim from there to Hawaii?
Too many sharks.
Mm-hmm. No, you still could.
Still could. Yeah.
I can hear a naysayer making that kind of an argument to me. My course might be teaching people more historical thinking than a cover-jointed course, but they're still not learning very much. And I would have to concede that that's true. Teaching and learning is really hard within the limits of a college class of 40 to 200 kids. Under those conditions, it's hard to learn very much. I think my students are learning more than they used to when I was a coverer and a lecturer. But I wouldn't make any grand argument that they're learning a lot.
They're not swimming to Hawaii yet.
No. So they still need, you know, 10 more history courses to become good at historical thinking. You can't just do that in one course.
So what would you say to the faculty member who is like you years ago that knows something is wrong but is uncertain what they should do and how they should start?
Well, that's easy. There is a literature on this subject.
There is none.
Nobody is alone anymore. I felt like I was alone.
Well, you were.
When I started out and had to sort of invent from nothing. That was wrong.
You weren't alone?
I wasn't. There was a literature when I started out in the 90s. The thing was, the literature was mostly from the late 60s, early 70s.
Oh, right, yeah.
And then there was another kind of outpouring of literature back in the 19-teens on this subject.
Really? I did not know about that.
There have been recurring waves of historians arguing what I'm arguing, what I and others are arguing, maybe four or five times over the last 100 years. This has been a perpetual controversy in the profession, it turns out. But each generation is ignorant of the yeah. one before them that made the argument.
Yeah.
And I certainly was in the 90s. I didn't know that this was a big push back in the 60s and 70s. Well, and today the push is bigger than it has ever been because of the success of a movement called the Scholarship of Teaching and Learning. So there's a tremendous literature now in places like the Journal of American History and in the History Teacher with ideas both large and small for how to revamp courses.
So
I would start there.
So my question is, my question is not as good as it was even 10 years ago. What about to the someone, first-year teacher, who's saying, yeah, I can see that there's a lot of scholarship to teaching and learning, but I'd rather keep on doing it in the generally accepted way. Okay. They're in that mode.
More power to you. You know, I don't think anybody's going to change until they've had something happen that shows them the futility of the traditional coverage method. For me, it was the day the professor died when I realized my students weren't even really listening to me. As good as my lecture was, they weren't listening to me. You got to have experiences like that. Then I think it helps to have a sort of an awareness that other people are changing and you're not just by yourself. And if you don't want to change, well, then you're not going to change.
And on that note, Lendell Calder, thanks so much for speaking with us. For more historical thinking, go to historicallythinking.org, where you can comment on today's program and find show notes, links, and readings related to today's conversation. Historically Thinking is recorded in the studio of WAUG, the student radio station of Augustana College. Our program's editor is John Ruddat. Beth Leimbach keeps the schedules in sync. Matt Lejas keeps WAUG studio running. I'm your host, Al Zambone. Talk to you next week.